Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you know what anything is worth? Most of us have to factor in our personal budgets when we decide what to buy and just how much we're willing to pay. But despite our best efforts to be educated consumers, we are often deeply and unconsciously influenced by the prices of the things we don't buy. And those influences often have very little to do with the true costs of production and distribution or the real value of anything. Writer William Poundstone explains what scientists have learned in his new book, Priceless: The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. Bill, welcome to Think.
Yes, good to be with you.
We all like to think of ourselves as smart consumers, but reading this book, it becomes clear that most of us have no idea what things should cost except relative to the cost of other products.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the things they've found in the past few years from looking at the psychology of decision-making. And they've realized that a lot of this applies to the decisions that we make in a supermarket or a department store.
Why are we more sensitive to differences in price than to absolute values?
Well, the interesting thing is that they find that this isn't just true with prices. It's really true with all sorts of sensory perceptions. I mean, if you're in a dark room and someone shines a flashlight in your eyes, you're going to be very sensitive to that contrast, and you aren't going to be able to see anything else. And what they've found is that if you're exposed to a very high price, it makes other prices look cheap in comparison. And that's actually a trick that a lot of marketers are now using.
So we owe this kind of understanding largely to a field called psychophysics. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, psychophysics goes back to the 19th century when they started studying basically the connection between physical quantities like light and heat and so forth, and the actual subjective perceptions of them. And the main thing they found is that people are very sensitive to contrast, but not to absolute values. I mean, we've also seen those optical illusions where the color of a dot will change depending on whether you have it by different colored dots or the same colored dot. So you're really looking at the contrast in color. And they found that that's true even of the economic decisions that we make. When you make a decision about whether $20 is too much to pay for a steak on a restaurant, you're really influenced by recent contrast, like if there are other things on the menu that seem to be a lot more expensive.
So how do price consultants, first of all, you'll have to tell us what price consultants actually do, and then talk about how they capitalize on those findings of psychophysics.
Yeah, the price consultant is really a new profession. It really got its start in the 70s and 80s when they started scanning everything in supermarkets. So they had all this digital data about how much people bought and how much they paid for it. And they realized they could use this information to really learn a lot about how consumers make decisions. And this was also a very fertile time for the psychology of decision-making. I write about two very brilliant psychologists, Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, who were really hitting their stride then and showing how irrational we can be in making a lot of these economic decisions. So these price consultants really put the new psychology together with all this data that was coming out of barcodes and internet purchases, and they were really able to find what sort of sales or promotions people react to and what sort of things really don't make much effect. So these price consultants now have become a very major industry. I write about one called Simon Kucher and Partners, and if you look at their list of clients, it practically reads like the Fortune 500. They advise both Coke and Pepsi on pricing, which in the field like advertising, Coke and Pepsi would never have the same ad agency, but they do have the same price consultant. And they're also advising the major cell phone companies, airlines, banks, really all sorts of major companies, because they've kind of found that the same psychology applies whether you're selling airline tickets or toilet paper.
You brought up cell phone companies. I'm going to jump a little bit out of order here because this is something that really leapt out at me. The idea that we don't fully understand the actual value of things really plays into how much most of us pay every month for text messaging.
Yeah, that's a good example, because if you look at what the economic cost of a text message should be, based on what you pay for bandwidth on a cell phone, a fair price for it would probably be something like about 1/1000th of a penny per text message. And of course, many people are paying, the average is around 20 cents now. And the answer is really pure psychology. They found, first of all, that text messages are mainly sent by kids, and it's their parents paying the bills. And the parents, you know, were a little behind the curve. They were a little slow in even understanding what text messages were. So these companies found that they really could sell this idea that a text message is something valuable, it's something you should be paying about 20 cents for. And it's been a fantastically profitable enterprise. It's one of the few areas where both the prices have gone up in the past 10 years, and so has the demand.
On the other hand, I have an iPhone, and my understanding is that AT&T is really close to losing money on all that bandwidth that is, you know, sort of locked in for a fixed price every month.
Yeah, they were kind of surprised at how much people are accessing the Internet on the iPhone. So that's one case where they kind of were a little bit behind the times in setting the price for that. But one of the things that the price consultants really are notorious for is making cell phone bills so complicated, because they found that people have a very limited ability to deal with numerical information. So they make sure that when you're judging cell phone plans, I mean, there are just so many numbers. There are monthly fee, and there's so much per text message, and there's so much per calls after a certain amount, that it's very hard to make a rational decision about whether one plan is better than another. And in a situation like this, they found that people are very susceptible to something that they call flat rate bias. People just like the idea that they're going to pay one flat rate and thereafter everything is free. But that's fine, but in many cases they find that people don't use the service nearly as much as they thought they would, and the companies make a big profit because you're paying for this flat rate when you really don't need it.
So, Bill, how do retailers set anchor prices for things?
Yeah, anchoring is really one of those terms from psychophysics. Again, it's the idea that you're very sensitive to contrast. To get a good example, go to any really fancy store like a Prada, and one of the first things you'll see in the store is, say, a $17,000 handbag. And everyone looks at that and they shake their head and say, who would be crazy enough to pay $17,000 for a handbag? But then displayed next to it, they'll have like a $2,000 handbag and maybe an $800 handbag. And the funny thing is, suddenly they look relatively reasonable next to that $17,000 handbag. And that's actually how people think, and they've done in actual studies and shown that just by having that $17,000 handbag there, you're much more likely to spend more than you would have if you hadn't been exposed to it. Now, very few people are actually going to spend $17,000 for a handbag, but still, it has a psychological effect and causes you to open your wallet a little wider than you would have.
This makes me think about the Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog that has the his and hers items. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, that's certainly another classic example of anchoring in American marketing. Again, I mean, no one knows anyone who has actually bought those things, but everyone talks about them, and suddenly the other things in the Neiman Marcus catalog look a little bit more reasonably priced.
You know, and it's funny because I like to think that I'm not susceptible to any of this. I don't walk into stores that have $17,000 handbags, let alone $800 handbags. But, you know, I subscribe to a women's magazine, and they'll show like an haute couture outfit with some ridiculous price tag that runs into the thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And then next to it, they have the bargain outfit, where, you know, maybe $150 for a pair of shoes doesn't seem so crazy next to $1,500 shoes. And it is funny the way it affects the way you think about prices.
Yeah, one of the things that Kahneman and Tversky found was that, you know, everyone says, I'm not going to be affected by this. But when you do the actual experiments with people, you find that there is a huge statistical effect. And really, we're all affected by this. It's not a matter of being suckered by advertising. It's really part of the way the human mind works and how we all make these decisions that we have to make every day about whether such and such a price is too much to pay.
From an evolutionary basis, why are we wired that way?
Well, it's a good question, and they have had some interesting speculations. They think really that people are loss averse. In other words, it hurts more to lose money than to gain money. And this really has precedent maybe in like our ancient ancestors having to go out and hunt for food in the dead of winter. And if you're in a situation where, you know, there are certainly many risks to going out and hunting, you don't want to do it unless you really have to do it. So this makes you very conservative in a lot of your decision making, and that's really the basis of a lot of things that we see going on in modern marketing.
I was interested to read here that, interestingly, some things fail to sell if they are priced too low. What's going on there?
Yeah, actually, I was talking with one retailer who had a kiosk in a mall, and he was selling emeralds, and he had what he knew was a very good price because he was making very little profit on it. And he found that practically no one wanted the emeralds, and people would come up to them and say, you know, I know emeralds, and there must be something wrong with these emeralds if you're selling them at this price. So what he finally did was double the price, and suddenly his sales went way up. And what this shows is that really in many situations, we really are clueless about what things are worth. I mean, unless you're an expert, you don't know what a gemstone is worth. It's very hard now with our new electronics gear to know what you should be paying for a flat-screen TV. So you really do take a cue from the price tag. And you assume that that a $2,000 TV is better than a $1,400 TV. And although everyone says, you know, I make my independent decisions, I'm not affected by price, if you look at what people actually do from the scanner data, you find that it does make a huge, huge difference.
The other remarkable phenomenon is that we feel like we got a better deal if we bought that $2,000 TV marked down to $1,600 than if we bought the one that was the same size for $1,400 in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things they've found is that people pay almost as much attention to the discount as they do to the price itself. They assume that the one that was originally more expensive must be a better model, first of all, even though the only extra feature it may have is this this sort of bogus rebate that you're getting. So it is a very powerful motivator, and that's why you see now that about 40% of all TVs are now sold with one of these rebates.
And rebates, you find, are, if not a complete scam, because you can turn the paperwork in and actually get your money back, very few people actually follow all the steps and get that refund check.
Yeah, they certainly make it as difficult as possible. In fact, they have terms. Breakage is the fact that people don't actually get around to sending in the rebate coupon. And, of course, you have to cut off the UPS code so you can't return the thing, which people don't like to do. And then when they do finally send out the check, they will often send it in an envelope that's been engineered to look exactly like junk mail, so that many people simply toss it in the trash without opening it, and they end up, you know, that's pure profit since you don't cash the check.
It's funny that people are not more on top of this, because the rebate is very often the reason why people make a decision to buy a particular product.
Yeah, they've certainly found that people go hot and cold. At the very moment of decision, that rebate is absolutely crucial. But once you get home, the rebate becomes a chore that you've got to do, and you've got all the other things on your list of things to do, and very often you don't do it.
Writer William Poundstone is my guest. We're spending the hour talking about his new book, Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer William Poundstone. His newest book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bill, what's likely to happen when we are offered small, medium, and large items on a menu someplace?
Yeah, that's an example of what price consultants call extremeness aversion. And the classic example of it is Starbucks, where they have those three sizes of coffee, all with very confusing names, like tall, venti, and so forth. What they've found in that situation, if you really don't know what you want, you're far more likely to choose the middle choice. And Starbucks knows that, so the middle choice there is actually 16 ounces of coffee. So you're basically buying two cups of very expensive coffee there. And over time, you know, that obviously adds up. So it's something, anytime you see multiple sizes of something on a menu, it's a safe bet that they really know what they're doing and they know what you're going to pick.
Does that mean the small is usually a better deal?
Well, certainly if you want a more reasonable size of coffee, yeah, the small. Actually, a lot of Starbucks will sell you a small coffee, which is only 8 ounces, but it's not on the menu, and you have to ask for it specifically. Otherwise, they just give you what they call the tall, which is 12 ounces.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and first we'll talk to you, Blake in Hillsboro. Hi, Blake.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Mr. Poundstone, interesting topic today. There seems to be two related but separate things here. One is a market failure based on a lack of information on the consumer with regard to the fair value of the goods. The second is really a behavioral manipulation, and you're talking about the work of Tversky and Kinnaman and others. So those are, of course, those guys won the Nobel Prize for it, but people have been working on cognitive processes for a long time, and I'm wondering what other manipulations do marketing people do other than with regard to price value that's based on our cognitive processes?
Well, I suppose very broadly, all sorts of things that the marketers do is really, you know, involving our cognitive processes and the whole idea of deciding you want something and how much you want to pay for it. A lot of Kahneman and Tversky's research was specifically involved with setting a certain numerical value. And, of course, prices are a classic example of that. The classic experiment they did, they spun a wheel of fortune in front of a bunch of college students, and it would land on a certain number, and then they'd say, I want you to tell me, are there more or less African nations in the United Nations than that number? They would answer that, and then they would ask them to estimate what is the actual percentage of African nations in the United Nations. And what they found is that the students' answers to the second question were incredibly influenced by the number, the random number that came up on the wheel. Apparently, just having that number in your brain, in short-term memory, really does affect your guesstimate of the second thing you're trying to estimate. And one of the things the price consultants have realized is that that same principle applies anytime you're trying to estimate a number that happens to have a dollar sign in front of it. So if you're trying to decide whether, you know, $200 is a fair price for this suit, if you've just been exposed to an $800 suit, you're more likely to assume that this suit must be worth more than the $200, and maybe it would be a good thing to buy. So that's a classic case of manipulation that's based on one of these cognitive illusions that really had its origin in the psychology laboratory, but now it's become a very big part of marketing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will go next to Rockwall and speak with Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'd like to get some free advice here. I sell music online, and we're debating on increasing our prices, whether we're better off at like $16.50 or $16.99, the 99, the 50, the 95, that whole question. By the way, I'm ordering your book as we speak and on Amazon. It's $17.81.
Go figure. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, well, actually, when Steve Jobs started iTunes, they had a lot of thought about the psychology of what they should charge for it. because at that time, of course, you know, a whole generation of people had grown up getting all their music digital files for free. So the question was, how do you convince people to pay money for something that had been free? And one of the things they found is that people still infer value from the price. So if you say, we're charging 99 cents for these digital files, even though it's the same to every bit from the files you're getting from a pirate site, people still assume that the one you pay for has to somehow be better. And another thing they found is that there really is a magic quality to prices ending in 9 or 99. This is something that retailers have used since the 18th century, and for a long time, economists were very dismissive of it. They said, you know, this must be some sort of harmless retailer superstition, but people are more logical than that. They're not going to be affected by a price that ends in 9. But they found that they really are. In one experiment they did, they got a retailer of women's apparel that had a catalog to print up two versions of its catalog. Now, both versions had the exact same items, but in one they had prices ending in 9, like $39, and in another they had prices ending in 5, like $35. And what they found was that for the very same item, more people would buy it at $39 than at $35. Now, this makes no sense at all, but it really does have a big unconscious effect. So in terms of some free advice, I would say think very seriously about a price that does end in 99, like $17.99.
So let's talk about your book specifically. I think he said it was $17.81 now on Amazon. List price is $26.99. It only went on sale a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is the assumption by most publishers that that is an anchor price that they put on the little sticker and that very few people will actually pay that full amount?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much they think that way, but certainly that is the way it works with a lot of these online sales. You realize that you're probably going to get a book cheaper than the actual, you know, list price. But they do put a lot of thought into the list price, too, because at the bricks and mortar stores, very often that's what you're paying. So in this case, they did come up with that. The list price is $26.99, so they are using that little trick there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Josh in Rowlett. Hey, Josh.
Hi, I was calling because I work at a big box retailer, and I can see I'm daily exposed to the actual cost of a product, the markup on the product, and, you know, what we're actually selling it for. And what I was going to ask was, what is an actual, because they do have to make some money to the employees and the building, what's like a reasonable markup on products? Because I see everything from 10% to 300% on all kinds of stuff on the shelves.
Yeah, well, obviously it depends on your particular business model, you know, what your actual labor and rent costs are. But certainly in some areas like high fashion or jewelry, there's always a very big markup, and that's pretty much standard in the field. In fact, Simon Kucher & Partners has a publication on luxury goods, and they often end up scolding retailers for not charging enough for luxury goods, because when you're talking about something like a very high fashion dress or shoes or something like this, the only way the public really infers value is from the actual price tag. So that's a very important element of what they're actually selling.
Talk for a minute about why Walmart has a lower rate of money from every dollar that it sells, a lower profit margin than the 99-cent store.
Yeah, well, I should say that Walmart, you know, makes a, you know, is famous for really knowing the discounting field, and it does make a nice profit. But it is interesting. The 99-cent only store has a 40% profit margin, which is about twice that of Walmart. And the best explanation is it's, the psychology of that 99-cent pricing. This store actually started when a guy in Los Angeles who was running a liquor store had a lot of cheap wine that wasn't selling. So he figured he just put it all on one aisle with a big sign saying, anything here, 99 cents. And the surprising thing was things sold very quickly. And in some cases, he had actually raised the price. It was like 60 cents wine before, and it wasn't selling. But when he marked it 99 cents, suddenly people were buying it. And it was so amazing that he joked with his friends that, you know, hey, I ought to open a store where we sell everything for 99 cents. And eventually that joke became reality, and it's now this incredibly successful chain that really outdoes even Walmart in terms of profits.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Tim in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey there. Okay, so I've got two shirts, right? I bought one at Target. It's 100% cotton. It's like a plaid shirt made in, I think it was Bangladesh. I paid like 19 bucks for it. I also have another plaid shirt, cotton, that I bought from Banana Republic that was like 60 bucks on retail, but I got it on sale closer to the same price that I paid for the Target shirt, okay? Mm-hmm. So if, and it was also made, you know, overseas. Now, if I were to take the tag out of one shirt and put it in the other one and switch it back out, there is no way I would be able to tell the difference because they're both 100% cotton. So my question is, what am I paying for if I go into Banana Republic and buy the shirt, the cotton plaid shirt, at $60 that I'm not getting when I buy the shirt from Target for $19? Is it just marketing? Am I being duped into thinking that if I buy the shirt at $60, that somehow it's a better cotton shirt that was made in Bangladesh that has the same printing as the one that's 19 at Target?
Yeah.
Or is it actually better?
No, I think in many cases it's really pretty much the same materials, same workmanship, and it's really, you're looking at the power of anchoring. People really are willing to pay more if they're in a store where you see things that are much higher, and suddenly that makes the $60 look reasonable. Whereas in Target, you pay something a lot closer to the actual economic cost of it. In one of the most famous behavioral economics experiments, Richard Thaler asked a bunch of business executives to imagine how much they would be willing to pay for a bottle of their favorite beer on the beach. But he posed the question so that some people were asked to imagine that the beer had to come from the bar of a really fancy resort hotel. And in that situation, people were willing to pay more money for it. And other executives were asked, suppose the beer came from like a really run-down supermarket. And in that case, people were willing to pay less. Everyone says you're not affected by the ambiance of the store where you buy something. But in actual studies, if you look at it, you find that practically everyone is. And certainly the upper-class stores really thrive on that particular psychology.
So many stores now have a perpetual sales rack. It's not something that happens twice a year. There's always a section in the back for which I make a beeline that sort of has everything marked down. Are the full price items basically just an anchor to push the sales items?
Well, they certainly hope to sell, you know, some of the things at full price. But again, they know that a lot of them aren't going to sell at that price. And it is very good business to have a more or less continuous sale. We certainly saw a lot of that this past holiday season, where from Black Friday onward into January, you had wall-to-wall sales, which, you know, previously it used to be that, you know, it wouldn't be until after Christmas that you'd get those sales. And the reason really is that in this economy, you know, they figured they need to use all the psychology they can. So if you put something on sale at an unrealistically high price, then you can mark it down like even 70%, and suddenly, you know, anytime people see that there's a 70% markdown, their sales resistance practically vanishes. So it's a very effective thing to do, and you've seen a lot of companies doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. William Poundstone is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Priceless. Let's go next on the phones to Dale in Waxahachie. Hi, Dale.
Hello. Basically, I just wanted to mention that another marketing scheme that is very prevalent in the U.S. Now, overseas too, is you no longer see people selling things at a set price. I mean, things like automobiles, rent-to-own. It's more of, does it fit into your monthly budget? And you get a lot of people who are buying cars paying a lot more than they would normally pay for a vehicle just because of financing or whatever. They get it within their dollar amount that they are willing to pay per month, not even caring how much they're paying for the item itself.
So that you're paying for 5 years instead of four or something.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Bill?
Yes. One of the things that Amos Tversky was famous for saying is that you really don't choose among options. You choose among verbal descriptions of options. So if a car dealer is trying to sell you a car by what the monthly payment is going to be, I mean, he can find a way to make that sound very good, very logical, and very appealing. And you don't pay so much attention to what the actual cost of the car is going to be. And again, that can be very profitable for him. So in many cases like that, you really do have to make an effort to decide, you know, what's the reasonable way to look at this price and not accept the explanation that the salesperson is really handing to you.
We have an email here from Lori who writes, I've heard that in real estate, even prices like $360,000 are more successful than specific prices like $359,247. What do you think?
Well, you certain, because everyone's, you know, looking online for houses, there is something to be said for having something that's right in between a common range, because that way you get people saying they want, you know, up to $360,000 and from $360,000 to $370 or something. So you have to factor that in for one thing. One thing they've found, though, is that it's very effective to have a range of prices, which a lot of agents are now using. In other words, they'll say, instead of giving a specific price, they'll say, the listing price is like $380,000 to $400,000. And that's actually based directly on some psychological experiments where if you're given two prices, both of which may be lousy prices, somehow you're more likely to choose the better one because you can justify, well, at least I'm not getting, you know, the worst price there. It's, again, something that's very illogical, but if you look at the experiments, it does have a big effect on our decision-making. And particularly in a very tough real estate market, this is something that you're seeing a lot of.
William Poundstone is my guest. His newest book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. We'll get back to more of your calls in just a couple of minutes. You can get to us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer William Poundstone. His new book is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. Get to us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or join the conversation via email to think@kera.org. I have to tell you, Bill, I don't think I will ever enter a restaurant again in quite the same way after having read this book. Restaurants and their menus are really adept at this. And having read it, I've sort of paid attention lately. And they absolutely are controlling what we think is our own decision about what to buy.
Yeah, I've sort of had the same experience with you know, looking at menus now and realizing all these tricks. The basis of it is that when you're in a restaurant, you know, it's obviously not one of life's biggest decisions what you're going to order. You're trying to make witty table conversation. So you're really not paying all that much attention to the items and particularly the prices. So because of that, because you really have divided attention, it's very easy to manipulate people. And a lot of these price consultants are now showing restaurants how to do that. One of the things they've found is that even the typography matters. On old-fashioned type menus, all the prices are in a neat line on the right side of the column. But they found that when they do that, a lot of people will scan down the column to see what's cheapest and then pick something from among the cheapest items. Well, instead, they advise people to use center justification, which kind of breaks up the prices so they're sort of scattered all over the page. And this makes it a little harder to compare prices. And since you have limited attention, anything that makes it harder to compare prices really makes you less price sensitive. Another thing they've found is that the eye is really drawn to anything that's that stands out. Like if an item is inside a box, or if it's printed in boldface or in larger type. So if you see something in a box with big type, it's a safe bet that the chef knows that that's something that's very high profit for them, and that's something they're trying to get you to buy. Another thing they found is that anchoring applies very much to menus, too. In New York City, it's famous. There are several restaurants there that have like $100 hamburgers. Now, the secret is that hardly anyone, even in New York, pays $100 for a hamburger. But what happens is that you look at that and then look down the menu, and then you'll see, oh, there's a $50 steak, and you figure that's a good deal, even though if you hadn't first seen that $100 hamburger, you would have thought that that's a terrible buy. So a lot of these things do make a big effect, and it really affects the profit margin of a restaurant.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jerry in Irving. Hi, Jerry.
Good evening. Yes, I have a couple of comments. I'll be real, very brief. Has to do with counterfeiting. And now, there are common items, you know, golf clubs, things like that. Also, there are expensive artworks, which are counterfeited. And then that's one comment. I'd like the person to elaborate on the second one also, and that is that, in fact, as a young artist, they're warned to be careful about setting their price to begin with, because once they do, they set it too low, they'll have to climb out of that price scheme, and that's very hard for them. Then I watch this Antique Roadshow, and I wonder how in the world they price these things, because if I look back and I think, if it took me an effort to build this piece of furniture, I couldn't build it for the price they're wanting for this antique furniture. And then I see some of it, they're overpricing. Please elaborate on that. What's going on in people's minds?
Well, I think in art, above anything I even talk about, people really do tend to look at the price tag and then decide how much the thing is worth from that. In the book, I write about a British artist, Damien Hirst, who's been trying to sell this this artwork that's basically a platinum skull encrusted with diamonds, and his price is $100 million, more than has ever been paid for the artwork of a living artist. And as I say, this was actually a very smart instance of anchoring. They had it in a gallery, was shown at various places, and then it was announced that they had sold it. But it finally leaked out who the buyers were, and it turned out it was the artist himself and his accountant. And the reason they had done this was because they were then having a big auction of his artworks. And although this auction actually took place on the very day that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy and all the wealthy people were panicking, 98% of the works sold, and they got over like $200 million worth of art sold. So I think it's fair to say that a lot of that was just because people had been exposed to this outrageously expensive price for this one artwork, that it kind of raised their estimate of what a Damien Hirst work is actually worth. So I think you make some very good points there. With art, you've really got to look at your price tags, because people are going to assume it's worth whatever you say it's worth.
It is sort of a little stroke of evil genius, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk for a minute about how we perceive value when two things are bundled together. In some cases, two things that we don't particularly want the second item of, but it comes along with, you know, a free razor blade with our toothbrush or something.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one of the basic principles of infomercials. If you look at these, and I looked at actually a big assortment of various infomercials, if they all pretty much have the same plot. That they're not just selling that Snuggie, they're also going to throw in a book light, they're going to throw in a second Snuggie, a second book light, and all these other features. And the reason they do things that way is a principle that's been called, don't wrap all the Christmas presents in one box. In other words, people like the idea that they're getting, you know, many different little features as opposed to one big, great product. And it's very effective in convincing people to, you know, get up and go to the phone and order something. So that's why you see with all these infomercials, they'll have like various add-ons, like the Ginzu knife really started it. where they weren't just selling the knife, they were selling a potato peeler, they were selling a core, they were selling all these different things, none of which was really worth very much money, but they did play a big role in your decision-making.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next in Irving to Tashina. Hi, Tashina.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was wondering, how can I use this all of this information about marketing and price value to market myself? I'm about to graduate from college, and I want to know how I can use this to really market myself and get myself the most money possible.
Yeah, one of the most important things they've found, and I go into this quite a bit in the book, is salary negotiations. They've found that the first number mentioned in a salary negotiation does have a huge effect on the final negotiated price you end up with. So the message there really is that you want to be the first person to name a price. Now, this is interesting because I think, even in my own experience, and I think most people, people really don't know what they're worth. So you kind of figure, well, I'm going to let the employer make an offer first, and whatever he says, I'll say that's not enough, and then I'll try to negotiate up from there. But if you look at actual experiments they've done and surveys, they've found that whoever names the first number has a huge statistical advantage. So you should always be the first one to name a salary figure. Now, fortunately, nowadays, I mean, there are websites like salary.com where you can get a pretty good idea of what you're worth in the current market. And they'll even give you like a little bell curve saying, you know, 90% of people make less than this figure. Well, that 90% figure is actually a good place to start in your negotiations. You won't necessarily get that much, but you will probably end up with more than you would have by letting the employer make the offer first.
And when you're negotiating for a car, bring a couple of buddies with you.
Yeah, they found, too, that one way to counteract anchoring is to have sympathetic friends with you. Because in these negotiations, the car dealer is going to say that, you know, everything you think you know about the actual retail price of the car, the holdbacks and everything, they're going to say that's all wrong. And they found that when people have sympathetic friends with them, they're much less susceptible to that sort of argument, and it does have a real difference in how much you're going to end up paying. Now, a lot of people figure, oh, you know, it's nice to have a friend, but I really don't need that. I'm too rational. But if you look at what actually happens, even very hard-headed, good business people are affected by whether you have a sympathetic friend along.
Let's go next on the phones to Granbury, and we'll speak with Deb. Hello, Deb.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, I had a question for your guest about the price of text messaging he had mentioned, but I had to step out of the car, so I didn't hear what he said. But I did hear that he said that we're paying way more than what it actually costs. My husband used to work in telecom, and I think everybody would be appalled if they knew how much all these pieces and parts of phones and the actual services actually are. Is there any way to boycott? It's not so much that I support that price as what I'm willing to pay. Is there any way to boycott that price? I just feel like we're trapped as the public in paying an outrageous amount for text messaging.
Yeah, I mean, there are various plans, but the only thing you can really do is make a very careful study of what your actual usage of it is and then find a plan that's best suited to that. But as I say, they make it as hard as possible to do that with all these very complicated plans. It would be kind of nice if we had much simpler plans like we used to before, you know, the price consultants really got into this, but that's pretty much what we're dealing with today.
I want to get to some of the great information you have here about what takes place at the supermarket, which is one of those places that nobody can really avoid shopping on a regular basis. Sometimes it seems like the prices stay flat for a very long time, but the amount of product we're buying changes and shrinks over the years.
Yeah, one of the very first things that the price consultants really found when they started looking at supermarket scanner data was that every time a manufacturer raised the price of something, people switched brands. And obviously, they don't want you to do that. But when you think about it, I mean, it's not just corporate greed. I mean, just because of inflation, every manufacturer has to raise prices from now and then. But they found a way to get around that, and that is to shrink the packages so that you're actually getting a little less. Like if you look at a Skippy peanut butter jar and turn it over, you'll now see that there's a pretty good-sized dent in the bottom of the jar. And that was put in there a couple years ago to take about an ounce and a half out of the jar so that they could keep the price the same while essentially raising it. And they've done the same things with cereal boxes. Kellogg's made their boxes a little thinner so that they look the same on the shelf, but they actually contain less of the cereal. And pretty much all the manufacturers of big consumer products now do this, and the answer, again, is pure psychology. People notice if you raise the price of something that they buy very frequently, but they don't notice if the box is a little different and contains a little less.
And those loyalty discount cards we all are trained to whip out at the cash register actually help them to do that.
Yeah, what they found is it's really the most price-sensitive people who religiously swipe those cards because, you know, you can't bear the thought that I'm going to lose a 50% discount on something. So this tells them what things people buy most frequently and what things people don't buy so much or buy very rarely. And that's important because if you buy something frequently enough, like peanut butter, you're going to remember the last price and you'll be affected, so they have to shrink the packages. But if it's something like pomegranate juice, where they found that most people just buy it occasionally, you're probably not going to remember what you paid the last time. So there, they've got a lot more scope to raise prices as the need arises.
Has online shopping done anything to flatten prices or to change the way things are anchored in the economy?
Well, that's interesting. About 10 years ago, the big pitch was that the Internet is going to liberate consumers, that they can really compare and get the best prices. But they've really found that that's not the case, that, again, you have a limited ability to deal with all this information. And they've also taken some countermeasures, like if you try to buy electronics and try to punch in, the model number of a specific refrigerator or TV, you'll find that it's like 17 letters and numbers. It's very hard to punch in all those numbers correctly, which makes it hard to find the exact same thing at some other store. They've also found, actually, that even website design can be a good way of manipulating people. And just based on the background images, they can really get you to buy something that's more expensive than you would have chosen otherwise.
So in the last 15 seconds or so, do you just count to 10 now before you make a purchase, or what do you do to make sure that you're not getting taken?
Well, I think it's very good to know some of these tricks because, to some extent, forewarned is forearmed.
The new book by writer William Poundstone is called Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. William, lots of great things to think about. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.